Addiction never affects just the addict. It affects all of us. Recovering from addiction and alcoholism is also a life-changing battle for families dealing with a loved one's addiction. Numerous programs support addicts as they reclaim their lives, while their families face their own challenges without the same guidance. You're listening to Voices in Courage with K.L. Wells, where we transform the lives of the families and loved ones of addicts and alcoholics from surviving to thriving in the midst of chaos. Tune in as we highlight vulnerable stories of families who have addicted relatives and friends and learn how they have dealt with the challenges of isolation, desperation, and shame. If you are seeking ways to live your best life, then we welcome you into this safe space. Be a part of change today with your host, K.L. Wells.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Voices in Courage podcast. I am here today with our founder and host, K.L. Wells. K.L., how are you today?
I'm great, ready to talk about the main topic on the floor.
Excellent. K.L. just returned from a trip back east to Nashville, where she attended the Vistage Chair World. And today we're going to talk a little bit about some lessons learned, some highlights, some insights, some conversations that were had, and maybe some conversations that we should be having. So welcome back. And K.L., I'd love to dive right in and give us a little teaser and some feedback on what you learned over the last few days.
Well, it's always interesting to me to step back into the executive leadership space and to see what kinds of conversations we're having and what kind of conversations we're not having related to drugs and alcohol. And because one out of three American families are dealing with this right now, it is in the C-suite. It is in the executive suite. And because of the work that I do as an executive coach and consultant, it is just about everywhere I turn. And so, you know, obviously we're out and having these conversations with a lot of people. And what I'm still experiencing is this broad landscape of we're going to talk about it, or we're not going to talk about it, or we're going to dance around it, or we're going to act as if it doesn't exist. And so we're still in this really interesting place, given the magnitude of what I would consider a pandemic at this point.
Yeah. I've always wondered this as you're going through these conferences and having these meetings where you would typically focus on leadership topics. Mm-hmm. Where is that, or how do you find that little inroad, or where's that little permissive voice that says, I'm going to shift the conversation a little bit? How does the topic of alcoholism, addiction, and other drugs come into conversations at this level?
Well, at this point, how it's kind of entering the conversation is through the lens of, you know, as a coach and consultant, what are we normally seeing in our practices that are the societal issues of our time? You know, rampant suicide, depression, anxiety, stress, adult children with alcoholism. It's all across the board. And it appears to be coming in waves now. And so alcoholism and drug addiction is in amongst a whole lot of things that we're dealing with as a society and as a culture. And so it gets lumped in there. And what I would say is there are absolutely crossovers in terms of how we talk about this and dropping the stigma and the judgment that goes along with this. And there are some nuances to this because it is different to talk about a disease of alcoholism and drug addiction versus potentially mental health issues, although those obviously overlap, or societal issues such as stress, anxiety, and those kinds of things that are taking place. And so there's this weaving that's taking place and across the board, real variety in terms of how open and available and how willing we are to have these conversations.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, it's kind of like where we were 10 years ago with mental health when it was taboo. Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden people will openly talk about mental health as if it were something that's just part of our everyday, as it should. Still in that space of awkwardness. And then we're still in that space where I find a lot of times when you talk about the disease of, people still kind of go almost like that, not even attaching the word disease to alcoholism and addiction. So that is still there the same way we would talk about cancer. When you start to, I don't want to say, or maybe guide or lead the discussion into that realm that's a little bit more unknown, do you find people just kind of do this bottle up? Are people starting to feel more vulnerable and safe to be able to discuss it?
I think there's a combination. There are certainly people that I've run into that if it doesn't fit in a spreadsheet, we're not going there. And so then they don't create a psychologically safe space for that conversation to come up. And so I'm very open and psychologically safe with all the people that I work with. And so as I begin to kind of poke at whether somebody's open to having a conversation or not, when they are open, then I find out that their experience is similar to mine in that we're seeing it in our practices a lot. And then the next kind of step is, well, what are you doing to kind of hold the space for people to have these conversations or executives to have these conversations in a way that they feel heard and seen without judgment and stigma, and that they can actually kind of talk it out? Because most of the time, we're carrying stuff around in our heads. Yeah. And it isn't until we like say it out loud where it like, oh, okay, I actually heard myself say that. And it lands differently. And so to be able to speak it and talk about it, what I find is the people that are open to doing that, it's a huge weight off their shoulders for one thing, because they've just been carrying it for so long. And then the other piece is, if you are somebody who's dealing with an exec or an executive team that, for instance, you know, one of my stories is CEO's son overdosed and died. And how do you have these conversations with them so that they feel like they can kind of get their feet up under them and then learn the skill sets to be in this at the same time? And I was talking about this earlier today, is one of the things that I find fascinating, particularly for people that are in my seat, is this notion of what are you doing to prepare yourself for your day? Because every time I have a meeting, I have no idea what's going to show up.
Right.
I don't know if the story of a nephew trying to commit suicide is going to show up. A spouse just died. A mother from a three-generational family business just died. A sister, a brother. I have no idea when I show up to meet with somebody, what's going to show up to meet me. And so I do quite a bit of preparation to set myself in a place, peace and calm, so that whatever comes my way, I am prepared to hold the space for people. And then what do people do at the end of the day to kind of end their day, complete their day, but leave that stuff behind, because it's not our job to carry it forward.
Yeah.
And so it's the self-care piece for coaches and consultants, but it's also the self-care piece for executives, because they have employees. And what we know to be true is that 50% of our employees are distracted by the stuff that's taking place at home.
I had a conversation recently, and I was working with a woman who focuses on trauma, grief, and loss. And we were talking about it as it relates to the workplace. And, you know, it's standard that we have sexual harassment training, we have ethics training, we have all of these training programs that come from HR, whatever it is, mandatory. Not once are we a grief-informed, trauma-informed, or addiction-informed organization.
And Absolutely. We're
behind on that.
Yes.
And we talk about, okay, yeah, we can have conversations at the top, at the C-suite level, but what does that do in terms of getting a culture involved around that? So a conversation was interesting. And, you know, how do you start to bring in workplace training and bringing those safe places around addiction, just like anything else that happens in the workplace? There was, I'm trying to remember the number that Mental Health America put out there, billions of dollars in lost productivity because of addiction and other issues happening in the workplace that quite frankly, no one knows how to handle.
Right. Exactly. I mean, first is we have to allow for the conversations to begin to take place. And as much as possible, I believe that execs need to be skilled up. And we are absolutely in that time now. Daniel Pink, who was one of the major thought leaders of our time, has spoken to recently this notion that, you know, the left brain executives of the past were the ones who ruled. The future executives of the future executives are going to be right brain, and which is creativity and possibilities and seeing how dots connect in ways that other people don't see that, and much more empathetic and compassionate and able to hold conversations of this kind of import. So we have a whole transformation that we're just at the beginning of in terms of getting comfortable with talking about this, if we have it in our families, owning it, and then making it safe for our employees.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In reflection, I can't believe it's already February of 2023, but you know, we did a lot of retrospective thinking over the last 30 days and thinking about what are the things coming out of the pandemic, moving more towards a conversation and narrative that us as an organization we're trying to change. Some lessons learned. What are some of those aha moments that have popped out for you that may be evident or maybe completely unexpected?
You know, I think back to some of the podcasts that we've done, and one in particular was the gentleman spoke to this notion of never giving up hope. And the way that I think about it is, it's like you never know when you're 5 minutes away from the miracle. And I'm not just talking about the miracle of somebody that you love deciding to really tackle the disease and in whatever form that takes. But I'm also talking about the miracle that occurs when a loved one is comfortable with loving deeply and being in the pain with somebody that they love. And that, again, is a skill set, a mindset, a heart set to get to. And it's been something that, you know, I've evolved to over time, is that my job is not to, quote, fix my son or make him well or whatever along those lines. What we know to be true about addiction through Dr. Gabor Mehta is that addiction and alcoholism is rooted in trauma. So my job as a mom and as an exec and as a coach and a consultant is to help people lean into the pain and move through the pain to the other side. And because I've done that myself personally so many times, I know the journey. Mm-hmm. So I can hold the space for the pain and work with people to be in it, express it, release it, and begin to move to the other side of it. And that is extraordinarily valuable for people. And even with my son, you know, he needed to lean into the pain of, quite frankly, at the end, wanting to kill himself. He was so like, he had just tapped out. He had done everything he knew to do. He was just dark and desperate for this disease to stop, to the point of wanting to kill himself, because that was the thing he only thought about at that moment. Yeah. And there was this moment where he looked at a picture and he thought about us and he made a different decision.
Yeah.
And he decided to lean into the pain and the suffering of getting clean and sober.
You touched on something that Dr. Gabor had said around addiction and alcoholism being rooted in trauma. And one of the things that I've learned to be true over the last couple of years is that trauma is never to be compared. And
nope.
We can't rank trauma on a scale of 1 to 10. And how many times people have said, well, my trauma isn't that bad, so I don't ever talk about it because I don't want people to think that I'm complaining or whatever it is. And for me, also, you know, being in recovery myself, my trauma wasn't being in a war-torn country or my parents passing away or being diagnosed with, you know, you think about these kinds of traumas that we immediately associate with, you know, these incredible circumstances and responses. Mine was simply fear of failure and being betrayed at the office. Things that you wouldn't normally set you off per se. But when you look at it in context and then you start to really look into all of the things that happen, your self-belief, all of that stuff, the narratives that play, the trauma all of a sudden goes up into this massive story that you've concocted in your head. And all of a sudden, so that was a big aha for me, is this idea of people think about the disease of alcoholism and addiction relating to some huge, massive, catastrophic event when trauma can be very, very simple.
Yes. Well, I think this is the misnomer about what trauma really is people tend to think about the situation or the circumstances of trauma, what happened. And that is not the issue. The issue is, what's the meaning that we make out of the situation or circumstance? And that's always the issue. So it's the stories we make up in our heads. It's the beliefs that we carry around that, quote, activate the trauma into such a pain for us that we want to get away from the pain.
Yeah.
That's the differentiation. And that's where we're kind of caught in this really illusional land, is that we're thinking about comparing traumas. We're only comparing situations or circumstances. That has nothing to do with this. You peel it back a little farther, it's like, okay, so what's the meaning that we attach to whatever took place? And what are the stories we tell ourselves? What are the beliefs that we have? What are the thoughts that we think? And that's where the work is.
Yeah, I bring that up because I think sometimes, or at least I've noticed, when we talk about grief or loss or trauma in the office, there's mm-hmm. this almost like this, we only speak of trauma when it just, when it affects the whole organization, or we, mm-hmm. it takes something so large for it to be discussed. And that's what I've just, you know, one of those aha moments for me was talk about the small stuff, because the small stuff ends up becoming some of the most catastrophic. And that's what it was for me too. I took something really small, a moment in time, and I turned it into a catastrophic event for myself.
Yeah. Well, you turned it into a monumental pain that you couldn't bear. And the only avenue that you sought at that time was drinking. And that's what I would say is, no matter what it is, we make it into such a monumental pain that we can't bear it. Mm-hmm. And when we can't bear it and we only hold it interior to ourselves, then we are cutting off our life support.
Yeah.
And so that's another reason why the whole notion of the stigma has got to stop. The judgment has got to stop, because things could become so much easier to bear if we just gave voice to it and realized we're never alone in this. There are well-worn paths of people that have been through all the things and made different meaning out of it and have different stories about it and have created habits of thought and habits of behavior that have helped them work through the pain and get to the other side. And so that's where the skill sets are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
on that as well, I mean, I've worked at companies where you do not mix business and your personal life. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like church and state. There's mm-hmm. no way these are going to commingle. Mm-hmm. And then other organizations where, again, it's that more mm-hmm. freedom to have an open dialogue and whatnot. And I think part of it too is the changing workplace culture, not just necessarily from the top down, mm-hmm. from the bottom up. And that's one thing I've learned is sometimes the people that are, you know, entrenched in the day-to-day work that are really driving productivity and culture and strategy and creativity, all of those individuals, mm-hmm. that's where a lot of that stuff should start and allow it to rise to the top. And I think historically we've, and at least the way I grew up was leadership up here, and they're always, you know, kind of mm-hmm. allowing things to trickle down.
Mm-hmm.
To me, this is one of those powerful things that the trickle up effect could have a lot of influence on how we change the narrative as well.
Well, I think that's what's showing up in our labor force today. And at the same time, my experience has been when I lead with vulnerability, people follow. When I lead with my own truth, people follow. And so I really do believe that part of my role and responsibility as a genuine, authentic, courageous leader is to lead with vulnerability, to lead with the truth of my own personal journey, not laying it on people, but giving them permission to have these conversations also. And so I think it's all across the board. But what I can tell you is I've been in plenty of organizations where unless the top is willing to be vulnerable and have these conversations, the bottom sure as heck isn't.
Yeah.
Nope. And this whole notion, I don't know who made it up. I would love to get my hands on them. But I don't know who made it up that we, you know, we separate ourselves at the door when we walk through the door of work. We do not. We never have. We never will. That is a complete illusion and denial of what's taking place. And it comes, I mean, I really do believe that it comes from this notion that people aren't people. They're just things to get things done.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. And so if you still believe that, then you're going to get left behind. And I think the financial success of tomorrow.
One of the number one things that millennials are now looking for in companies and places to work for mm-hmm. is the culture, which mm-hmm. a lot of times that wasn't necessarily the case. Mm-hmm. It was image of the brand, success of the brand, how much money I can make. It was all about kind of those ego serving kinds of things at the top.
Mm-hmm.
And now a lot of it's the soft skill stuff. It's mm-hmm. do I have the ability to be a part of something that's amazing? Is my voice going to be heard? Can I have creativity as well as strategy and this and that? And the millennials are demanding it. So mm-hmm. that's
well, and the millennials are the loudest voice along these lines. But I will tell you, as a baby boomer, this has been the world that I've lived in for 4 decades. Is I have always believed that a human being walked in first. I've always believed that we were always going to be more powerful if we galvanized together for a shared fate of meaning that mattered. And so my work has been at the edges of what now is emerging. So I remember early in my career when people would say to me, well, you know, the employee leaves their personal stuff at home. And I just said, BS.
Yeah.
That is absolutely not true. When somebody has a sick child at home, trust me, when they come to work, that's what they're thinking about. And so I created these spaces, you know, fortunately, I had the opportunity and I have enough companies now that I can do this to create safe space for people to bring their humanity to work and feel that they are seen and heard. And for some people, this can be the only break they get from the stuff that's going on at home.
Yeah.
And so I'm willing to give them that. And sometimes I will tell you, there are enough execs that I work with, I may be the only hug they get that week or that month.
Yeah.
But I can tell you, every single one of the people that I work with gets a hug.
Yeah.
They know that I love them. I tell them, you know, so it is a relationship, as far as I'm concerned, for the long term, no matter how long I work with them or how short I work with them.
Yeah.
And they know it. And it gives them permission to be human.
Yeah. All right. Anything else, lessons learned coming up from podcasts that we've done, aha moments from last year, even outside of the executive space, anything that came up? I'm just trying to think if there's something specific. One of the things that I had a lot of conversations with last year with individuals was this idea of the shattered dream. Here's the expectation of what everything's going to be, you know, put out in front of me.
Yeah.
What happens?
Yeah. Yeah.
The shower door, when you close it too heavy and all of a sudden it shatters into a million pieces.
Right.
How much of that is becoming more prevalent than ever, especially coming out of a pandemic where it was like, and I talked about this with my dad all the time, you know, his generation was like, boop, 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 there goes the ladder. And then ours is like suspension bridge that's like going all over the place.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're in this space where we're trying to figure out like who we are in this and what's really true and what's not true. And I certainly out of the pandemic, that gave a crystallization of what really matters. At the end of the day, so many people were lost and it got really clear really quickly what was really important. And corporations that did not care at all who you were or anything about your family, I'm sorry, I'm not going to spend 8, 10 hours, sometimes 12 hours a day working for somebody who doesn't give a nitwit about me and who doesn't understand that I want to spend time with my family. Because at the old enough at this point that when I kind of go off into the sunset, so to speak, I'm very clear. I want my friends and family around me. Those are the people in my life that matter the most. And I want them to know, and I'm very clear about delivering that message on a consistent basis that I love them, I appreciate them, and I say thank you a lot. And so we're in the throes of this cultural, spiritual, societal transformation at this point. And we're questioning the things that we thought to be true. You know, it's that notion of the unquestioned answers. What's really true and what's really not true? And I've talked about this before is we are surrounded by a paradigm of power over and control of, which means the more money you have, the more power you have, the more prestige you have, the more things you have, the more important you are.
Yeah.
Which is complete BS. Anybody who has money, power, things, and all of it, who gets to the end of their life, none of that goes with them.
Yeah.
And so in the corporate arena, we're seeing more and more executives, CEOs, and C-suite executives that are willing to actually look at what is success.
Yeah.
Success is not just success at work. If I have success at work, but my family is in shatters, I have a divorce, I have kids that, you know, are going here and going there, and all the things are unraveling from a personal perspective, that's not success. And so to some extent, a lot of people have kind of bought into the notion of, you get the degree, you get the pedigree, you get the job, you make a lot of money, but basically you're selling your soul to the job.
Yeah.
And now people are waking up more and more to the notion that, wow, that is actually soul severing and soul sucking. And I don't know that I'm willing to do that anymore. So for instance, I met somebody at this conference that I was at, and it was a husband, wife. The husband is a Vistage chair and the wife was accompanying him. And I got to have a great conversation with her. And she said during the pandemic, they moved to the country. And so he does his work now, 2 weeks of the month. Mm-hmm. And then they spend 2 weeks of the month in the country. Mm-hmm. They have completely reoriented their life to the things that matter most to them at this point. Yeah. And I'm talking to more and more people who are doing that, or more and more people who want to do that. They're just not sure how to unravel what they've created. And I work with a lot of people to help them unravel what they've created and recreate a life that they're inspired to live.
There was something very symbolic yesterday. We were living here in San Diego. We went down into the harbor and we were sitting there just enjoying the afternoon sun. And as you look out into the harbor, there's, I mean, hundreds of boats. But right where we were, there was this, I mean, enormous yacht. I mean, it was absolutely enormous enough where we Googled it just to see. Owned by a billionaire, $150 million ship. Mm-hmm. Right next to it, literally sharing the same slip, is this probably 20 to 30K motorboat that goes out in the ocean, whatever it is.
Right.
$150 million yacht, closed up, cold, mm-hmm. shutters down the whole thing. Here comes this happy couple mm-hmm. with a pizza box in hand, a box of wine.
Right.
Comes with their little boat and they're laughing, they're having fun. But the juxtapositioning of mm-hmm. $150 million versus the happiness next to it, it's like, mm-hmm. take that in a heartbeat.
Right.
It was one of those kind of, we kept seeing the people walk down. Are they going to go on? No, it was really fun to see that.
Yeah. The juxtaposition now is much more alive and well. People are noticing this more. And so I think that's one of the great gifts out of COVID and the times that we're living in is that people are actually questioning what is the life that inspires them and unraveling the life that they thought they were supposed to live or they should live. And like I said, I mean, I work with a lot of family-owned businesses. And I mean, how many second, third, fourth generations take on the mantle of the family-owned business and they are miserable because it is not their life's purpose or calling. And so to the ones that are courageous enough to have these conversations that are real and raw, then we begin to help pull back the layers mm-hmm. to examine, do they really, really want to do this? I mean, in particular, one family that had been three generations, to the parents' credit, I met with the next generation to work with them to find out, did they really, truly, in their heart of hearts, want to take on the family business? And one of them was dealing in recovery from alcoholism at that point. But one of the things that was heavy on that person's shoulders was the guilt of not taking on the family business.
Yeah.
And so I was kind of that intermediary to yeah. give them permission and say, trust me when I say your parents will support you completely if you do not want to take this family business on. And it took months before it finally kind of sunk in and they believed that that was actually the truth. And then they opted out. They were free. You know.
And at the end of the day, they're emotionally fit. Mm-hmm. Business stays fit and they bring the right people in to carry on the business. So everyone right. wins.
Yes, exactly.
Person loses, the business loses, legacy loses.
Right, yep. Exactly. Yes. And so, you know, what you said there, this was one of the things that came out of my time in Nashville was this clarity around emotional fitness. Is we talk a lot about emotional intelligence. They're very different things. I mean, emotional intelligence is you can actually read somebody. You can show up with empathy and compassion. You have the ability to be present with somebody. And emotional fitness is when you find yourself like knocked upside the head with something that shows up like out of the blue, you have the ability and the skill set to do what you need to do in a relatively short period of time and then be super present and in a place where you can make really great decisions out of creativity and possibilities. And that is a skill set. And that's part of the world that I live in, is helping people develop that skill set, believe that they can, for one thing, that they are not at the whim of whatever shows up, or they're not stuck. I mean, we had this conversation earlier about like stuck and I can't see my way out of this. And that's part of the disease, is you get in this hole, whether you're a loved one or whether you're somebody who's dealing with the disease, where you just get stuck and you just need somebody to like give you a little hand up and help you see it a little differently and help you take that next step out of the darkness. And getting back to Daniel Pink again earlier, was what he talked about is we live in the framework right now of you want to get the information so that you can know what your next steps are. And he said, we're not in that place anymore because nobody knows what's going to happen. We're in uncertainty, unknown, it's uncharted territories. And he said, so now we've got to flip it. You just need to act and then figure it out. And that's the same thing for addiction and alcoholism is we need to keep moving forward. We need to look for the people who have created a mindset, a heart set, a belief set that we aspire to get to and find out what they did to get there. Mm-hmm. And where does success reside? Because, you know, Jim Rohn said, success leaves clues. And that's what Voices and Courage is doing, is pulling the threads of thriving success so that people can move from crisis to struggling to surviving to thriving. And it's absolutely doable. We've all been on this journey. And so it's taking that next step. It's acting without knowing all the information, because we're never going to know all the information.
Well, and going back to kind of where we started is never give up hope. There's always a way. There's always a solution. And I think for far too long, we've turned a bit of a blind eye to it. And we haven't seen hope as necessarily something that we can buy into. But this is one of those things, having been in the trenches, having seen family in the trenches, having seen executives in the trenches, that this too shall pass. There is hope, there is a solution. And it's kind of why we continue to have these conversations and hope that more and more people see them, share them, and be a part of them, because those statistics are going the wrong direction. Mm-hmm. And used to be one in six men turned to substance abuse. Now it's 1 in 4. 5% of all suicides are men. It used to be 1 in 8 women turned to substances. Now it's 1 in 6. We're not trending in the right direction. And obviously the pandemic has shown that. And
I think the pandemic was a catalytic supercharger in kind of showing or exemplifying the fact that we are not skilled up. We don't have the skills, generally speaking, if the trends are going in the wrong direction, to be able to handle the pain, the uncertainty, the volatility, the unknowns. Well, I'm sorry, but that's life. And so we need to skill up and learn how to navigate in the midst of uncertainty and unknowns and disease and pain. And what most people are trying to do is stay away from the pain because it hurts. It's like putting your hand on a hot stove. What they don't understand is that it's like the chrysalis. You have to go through the pain to get to the miracle, to get to the best version of yourself. That's what creates amazing people.
I think for me it was one of those things where here's one more heavy thing on my plate. I can't take on one more thing. What I didn't realize is if I actually did take on that one heavy thing, it solved everything else.
Yes.
And I think that to me was a total mindset shift, was that if we add one more thing to the plate, what if that one more thing end up taking and clearing your plate for something pretty incredible.
Yes.
That's what I loved about being able to visualize the work that way for those that are struggling with getting into it, but can visualize really well. Imagine your plate being completely cleared. Mm-hmm. You just took one more courageous step to focus on something.
Yeah. And I think that goes hand in hand, Tucker, with this notion of pain pushes until vision pulls. Is pain is here to serve us.
Yeah.
And when you feel like life is falling apart, honest to God, I can speak from experience over and over and over again. It is actually falling together. And if it hadn't been for Sam's addiction, I would not be the person I am today. And I know it sounds crazy at times, but I am so grateful for his disease.
Yeah.
Because he was the catalyst for me to stretch, to grow, to get outside myself and become who I was meant to become.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a great parting comment per se. We've gone from here over to here, but I think at the end of the day, we spoke about and started with executive conversation and narrative, and we ended with a solution. It doesn't matter if you're in a home office, in the office, at home, in your community, it's all one and the same. It comes back to that. Any other parting comments per se, KL, as we wrap up our conversation today?
Well, I think what I'm thinking about right now is that today is Sam's 310th day of being clean and sober. And so there's something to be said about him leaning into his own disease and his own pain and coming out the other side and choosing life. And we had a conversation with him last night. And what my wife, Patty, said this morning was, she said, there's a maturity in him. There's a depth of vulnerability and honesty and trueness, genuineness to who he is now that wasn't present prior to this disease. And so to watch him as him unfolding into this light, compassionate, loving man, now almost ready to turn 32, he gives me hope for what's to come and who we are becoming. And so I want that for everybody who's listening to hear, because it's just one more thread of the emergence of a lighter, brighter world.
Well said. And congrats to Sam. That's quite a 180 from where we were just a few months back. So that's awesome.
That's for sure. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Tucker.
Well, thank you everyone for listening. This was a fantastic conversation. Thank you, KL, for sharing your ideas and your insights from your trip. And we look forward to seeing you on the next episode of the Voices Encourage podcast with KL Wells. Until then, stay strong, stay healthy, have the conversations, be vulnerable, be courageous, and help us change the narrative. And please visit us at voicesencourage.com. Sign up, be a part of. This community is growing. It's amazing. The resources are fantastic. All of those things, that questions that you have, find other individuals that are like-minded that are going through the exact same thing.
Yes.
We'd love to see you there. So
great. Thank you, Tucker. Bye.
Addiction never affects just the addict. It affects all of us. Recovering from addiction and alcoholism is also a life-changing battle for families dealing with a loved one's addiction. Numerous programs support addicts as they reclaim their lives, while their families face their own challenges without the same guidance. You're listening to Voices in Courage with KL Wells, where we transform the lives of the families and loved ones of addicts and alcoholics from surviving to thriving in the midst of chaos. Tune in as we highlight vulnerable stories of families who have addicted relatives and friends and learn how they have dealt with the challenges of isolation, desperation, and shame. If you are seeking ways to live your best life, then we welcome you into this safe space. Be a part of change today with your host, KL Wells.